A lot of objects to which the term luxury is ascribed to me don't seem luxurious at all. They seem mass-produced. They're made of expensive things, but essentially they're just rolling off a conveyor belt like anything else. And for me, true luxury, it can be a very humble thing, but it's something that's had time and love invested in it. It's not a fancy object, it's an object of utility. It's beautifully designed and it's perfect for what I need it to do. It's razor sharp. It uses techniques that have been honed over thousands of years of kind of slow, incremental technological human advancement, but are still as pertinent now as they ever were. I mean, for me, it's beautiful. It connects me with the history of my craft.
This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. Hello, I'm Mariella Frostrup, and this is True Tales of Luxury. In this series of podcasts from Harrods, I'm talking to artists and creatives about their work and their relationship with luxury. Today, I'm here with the chef and restaurateur, Jackson Boxer. His grandmother was the legendary food writer, Arabella Boxer, and he grew up steeped in good food. He wrote his first recipe book when he was just 6 and opened his first restaurant when he was just 23. He's now one of Britain's top chefs. Why, hello.
Hi.
Welcome, Jackson. Come on into our little
Harrods
boudoir.
It's wonderful to be here.
Have a seat. So, Jackson, it does seem that the whole world of food was something that was just deeply ingrained in you from an early age. Do you remember when you first got interested? And is that the case? I mean, does coming from a family who all seem fascinated by food actually not make you want to rebel against it?
It's such an interesting question. I think I can't ever remember actually being interested in food. I remember being very greedy. I remember loving food. I had this lovely childhood of delicious things always being around and my parents being great hosts and both my grandmothers being phenomenal cooks in very different ways. And so as a result, the world was full of small, delicious things to eat and very, very stimulating as a result. My beautiful kind of childhood idyll was destroyed by being wrenched away to go to school, which was entirely my decision. I was kind of ferociously kind of independent, sorry. And
so what, you asked to go to boarding school?
Yeah, I liked the idea of it. And when I got there and found that the endless stream of delicious things that I was so used to...
completely
dried up. And I was miserable. And suddenly, at that point, I had a realization that actually I'd been incredibly lucky and that the food that I'd taken so for granted was entirely... symptomatic of the enormous amount of love that I'd had in my life till that stage.
And did you also realize that if you were going to eat well, you were going to have to cook it?
Funnily enough, I started cooking in earnest when my parents, who were great hosts, we'd be having lunch at the weekend and they'd start cooking lunch and then people would start arriving and nothing would happen. And I realized that if I didn't step in and take over, lunch just wouldn't happen either. It also kind of stemmed from this idea that, when I was... in my early adolescence and very, very ill at ease with myself, I think, as everyone is at that age, and had completely lost the easy facility with the people around me that I loved. I could barely hold a conversation with anyone because I was so self-conscious. But I found that if I cooked for people, it was a beautiful way of expressing my affection and love for them without necessarily needing to find the words, which so permanently escaped me. And it became the only way I could really engage with other people. And this sounds kind of dramatic, but I was a very introverted and bookish teen. And that really never stopped. I suppose when I hit the age of about 16, I wasn't really sure what to do, but I had kind of tons of energy and I needed to do something. And so I got a job as washing pots, as a pot wash, which is how lots of people start. And I found that kitchen life was incredibly addictive. You know, as a young man with no understanding of how the adult world really worked, but an enormous appetite for experience. Washing pots was an amazing life because you worked very hard, but you were treated like an adult and you got to sit and have a beer with the chefs at the end of the night. And it was kind of a really, really fizzingly exciting environment to be in.
Prompt you into your culinary career straight away, did it? Because you studied English and philosophy at Cambridge. So why did you go and do that? And at what point did you think, I'm going to follow the food path?
I loved my experience of working in restaurants when I was 16, but I had no understanding about what adulthood would truly feel like when I got out the other side. My parents were insistent that I should go to university, and both of them were committed to sending me to a kind of solid red brick left-wing institution. And as a result, I was determined to go to Cambridge. I actually had a great time. I spent 2 years there. I loved reading, and it was kind of, you know, you study English, you just read. It's kind of a lovely thing. But it also was slightly kind of stagnant. And I became very unhappy there after a couple of years because I felt that I was wasting my vigorous youth. And I felt not for any other reason than you know, this felt like a lovely but very privileged and cosseted existence. And I really should be doing something with myself. And so I took myself back to London, and I had aspirations to be a writer at that age, I think. But I didn't really know how one went about being one. So I thought that I'd go back to working in kitchens while I figured things out. Well, I'm still figuring them out, I guess. You know?
And when you were at uni, you know, also famously not a hotbed of culinary delights, were you quite popular for your abilities to whip up something slightly more tasty than the normal, you know, dining hall grub?
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, people talk about food being cool now. I remember no one would eat with me. I'd kind of say, everyone, come around and have dinner. I'm going to cook some food. And everyone would be like, why are you wasting it? You know, it's so bourgeois, your affectation, having dinner parties. I was like, it's not a dinner party. It's just food. Yeah. And now, of course, all my friends regularly kind of come and see me and eat my food, which is
But now you can
nice.
Make them pay for it, which is...
yeah, exactly. Who's laughing now? Food is delicious. We have to eat three times a day. It seems such a waste, such a pity to ever eat anything that isn't delicious. I think this idea that good food is always complex or takes a long time to cook is nonsense. It just involves being judicious in what you buy and getting something simple and fresh. You know, for me, it sounds incredibly trite, but a beautiful, well-proportioned salad of crunchy, green, fresh things with a pungent dressing of mustard and shallots is that's a delicious meal, you know? Stick a nice piece of cheese and some good bread on the side. I'm so happy with that.
Would that have featured in your six-year-old's recipe book?
So the thing I most clearly remember about being six, and the thing that I'll forever be incredibly great, among many things that I'll forever be very grateful to my maternal grandmother for, was she was called Diana, and she was an amazing gardener, and she lived on a farm in West Sussex. She cooked very well in a kind of classic English farmhouse style, but everything came from her garden. And when I was five, she gave me a corner of a flower bed and some seeds and taught me how to grow things. And the things she taught me to grow were radishes and carrots and lettuce. And I remember the first radish that I picked, and it was...
That I'd grown.
I thought it was absolutely disgusting. I'd never eaten something so fiery and peppery, but it was thrilling. It was absolutely thrilling.
So when did you decide you wanted to be a chef? Was it, you know, partly kind of been exposed also to Margot and Fergus Henderson when you were their babysitter?
It's funny you say that. I mean, I still don't think I really have decided to be a chef. I love cooking, and I feel immensely privileged that I've found a way to cook professionally. I think it's kind of, I can't really believe I'm so lucky to do this thing that I love so much as a job. However, there was an amazing component to being Margot's babysitter in that, you know, when I was kind of 15 or so and I looked after her kids and done their homework and put them to bed, then I'd probably pass out and I'd get prodded awake at, you know, 2 a.m, Margot having come back, and she'd say, "Jackson, you've got to go home." Okay, sure. I'm sneaking out the door. She said, "Before you go, it's very cold out. Come in and have a drink." And she'd pour me I probably wasn't 15. Maybe I was a little older at this stage. But she'd pour me a whiskey. She'd pour me a little whiskey to warm me up. And it was amazing. In her kitchen, who'd be in her kitchen? It would be, you know, just these incredible people. Just people I thought were absolutely extraordinary. Sarah Lucas and Michael Clark and other chefs like Jeremy Lee. You know, this kind of incredible panoply of artists and actors and dancers and designers. And I was like, wow, you cook people's dinner and then they hang out with you. This is, what a great job.
You've mentioned your maternal grandmother, but you haven't yet mentioned your paternal grandmother, who may well be seen as a more likely influence when it comes to food, you know, because of course she was the food writer, Arabella Boxer.
That's right. Yeah, no, everyone is so incredibly reverent and familiar with Arabella's work. Her influence on me is deep and profound. It's, I suppose, slightly more obvious, so I don't think about it as much, but it was incredibly profound. She used to take when we were at primary school, she'd pick me and my brother up after school once a week, and we'd do something lovely and treaty and kind of grandmotherly, like she'd take us to a museum or something, or go to the park. And then we'd go back to her beautiful flat, and she would cook us a very simple but really delicious, exquisite dinner. And I'd watch her in the kitchen, and the level of commitment and consideration and attention which she gave, even making something very simple, like kind of sausages and mashed potato, it wasn't laborious or effortful in the way that I saw other people cooking. It was kind of dutiful and considered and artful. And that has never left me at all. And then I understood that the kind of meditative component of food, the part of cooking which asks us to kind of focus on doing very, very mundane, repetitive things with a lot of care and attention so we don't cut our fingers off.
But it's interesting you say that, because that is, in many ways, you know, what people who love cooking think of as the luxury, the sort of meditative nature of it, and the languorousness and the luxury of fantastic ingredients and all of those things. But actually, a restaurant is the sort of opposite. It's chaos, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's absolute chaos compared to how most people would see a functional kitchen as running. Behind that chaos is obviously a huge amount of planning and order, but the adrenal kind of urgency of it. The adrenal urgency of professional cooking is kind of what makes it really fun. However, that's service. And outside of service, you have a kind of a much more silent application, which is the morning, where from 8 a.m. to midday when lunch starts, you're frantically and in kind of silent, relentless industry, kind of peeling onions, chopping carrots, sauteing vegetables, etc., etc. Yes, it is. They are different. However, in as much as you're really considering cooking something delicious that someone else is going to enjoy, which is kind of most of what home cooking is and kind of what most of professional cooking is too, they're very, very similar. And that's also the luxury of it. You get to kind of really devote some care and attention to doing something beautiful and really committed.
Introverted teenager struggling with confidence and with who you were. But you opened your first restaurant at the age of 23, which requires an enormous amount of confidence and chutzpah, if you will. So what happened? Where did that come from?
I mean, I was a funny combination of being very self-conscious and incredibly headstrong. If I'm honest, if I knew what it entailed at the time, I would never have done it. Ignorance can be an amazing thing. And a lot of my confidence was entirely foolhardy.
How do you mean? Like, how did you actually physically do it?
Well, it was a funny time because it was just after the crash. So it was 2009 or 2010. I suppose St. John is an interesting comparison because it opened in the early 90s.
The Margot and Fergus Henderson's restaurant.
Yeah. Exactly, which is, you know, still one of, you know, the most important restaurants in London, if not the world. In times of kind of financial insecurity and stuff, it's much easier to convince landlords who have nothing doing with a space to let you use it for a short amount of time. London did feel kind of empty and a bit listless at that stage. Oh, I'd supported my brother in setting up an amazing open-air restaurant and bar on the roof of a car park in Peckham the summer before, which which is a pop-up, mm-hmm. Exactly. But this, you know, pop-ups then, there wasn't a kind of currency around them.
Pop-ups, they weren't even now called a pop-up, I don't think.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, pop-ups now, you go and you sit in a car and, you know, it's sponsored by Mercedes and you drink a coffee and someone takes a picture of you and that's a pop-up. You know, then, I mean, this is only 10 years ago, but then it was really just there was an empty space, you put a table there, you cook some food and people come. And it's, you know, it was an idea of removing all the kind of infrastructure that make things expensive, complicated, and create a barrier of entry and freeing that up so that you can just do whatever the hell you want. And that was amazingly liberating. Whether London still has nearly as much potential for that, even 10 years on, is slightly dubious. It seems that every bit of unused space is now being converted into kind of flats or these kind of faux pop-ups. You know, it was lucky. There was a space, it was there. It was a marvellous salvage yard near where I grew up.
Lascaux,
yeah. Exactly. Their trades in expensive fireplace and chandeliers had taken a bit of a hit after 2008. They were still doing well, but they kind of felt like they wanted another string to their metaphorical bow. So it was very easy to kind of come together. I was like, look, just give me a corner of your shop. I'll cook some foods, you know, blah, 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 blah. Very simple. And it kind of rolled from there.
Did you have an idea of the sort of food that you were going to cook there?
It's so funny, isn't it? I never have any idea what kind of food I cook. For me, food is food, it's kind of almost secondary. It's like, it's kind of the spirit in which the food is cooked, which is for me the most important thing. When people ask what we cook these days, you know, that it's, you just trot out these kind of cliches. You say, oh, it's seasonal and oh, it's kind of sustainable. But actually, you know, these things are true. It's no longer even innovative to observe the seasons as we would have done traditionally. It's just the way, if you want to use the best produce, you use it at the peak of its quality, which is what happens to be in season now. And, you know, frankly, right now, what's good? We have bitter leaves coming over from Italy. We have beautiful citrus fruits. We have amazing seafood from the South Coast and from the North Seas. This is what we're cooking. And actually, that's a kind of a very thrilling way to write a menu. You look at what's around and kind of compose it judiciously so that each plate has a has an interesting makeup of textures and flavors and appearance. And that's your dish. And if it changes the next day, well, so be it. It is, more often than not, exactly what people want. In winter, people are drawn towards delicious kind of peppy, bitter leaves and sharp citrus. And you know, shellfish and fish. And, you know, in autumn, they are drawn to those rich or warm flavors of squash and courgette and pumpkin and game and whatnot. It's very alienating to live in the city. I find that one of the saddest times I've ever been in my career is when I was working very hard and I was never leaving the restaurant. I was never leaving the city. And I'd get a box of beetroot still with the dirt caked on and I'd hold it up like some kind of prisoner. And I'd be like, somewhere there is weather, there is earth. And, you know, as a result, and I have children now, but I make it almost a matter of principle to try and take them out of London as often as possible.
You've done everything very fast and very young, including having children.
It's because I'm an idiot.
Great, thanks. That's the answer I was looking for. But you know, obviously you had a period of kind of wild chef behaving badly, you know.
What have you heard?
I don't know.
I can't tell you, Tommy.
Yes. No, I think slightly famously you had your debauch period. Why do you think that goes sort of hand in hand with the whole frenetic nature of, you know, chefing business?
It's interesting, isn't it? First of all, I think that, you know, to give credit to most cooks, none of them were as badly behaved or as hedonistic as I was. Not necessarily. I think there are lots of cooks who actually are not like that at all. And I think it's very unfair to tarnish the whole industry with my misbehavior. I would say, however, though, that the lust and hunger for experience and sensation that makes cooking an incredibly exciting and attractive pastime goes hand in hand with other appetites which need to be explored. I certainly regret many things that I did in my 20s. However, I don't regret doing them, if that makes sense. I kind of feel, you know, nothing I did was particularly morally wrong, but a lot of it was very self-destructive. It's a mistake when you're exploring that kind of period of late adolescence in your teens and 20s to repress appetites which might later bubble up in more insidious ways. And I feel very, very grateful to have the kind of clarity and peace of mind that I have now, especially with my family. And I find my life and my work incredibly rewarding in a way that I didn't think was possible at that age. I thought that I was just a very tumultuous soul. And I thought that I kind of needed to push myself because it was the only experience of living that I understood. It was the only way I felt alive, to be high or drunk or, you know, constantly chasing kind of the next kind of rush of adrenaline and excitement. And for me, that was all I knew. I was certainly the right personality type to push it a bit too far. But I think that everything that gave me the ability to race ahead in other regards. So learning to look after myself and look after those around me is something that I've learned far too late. However, it's something I'm very grateful to now have a better understanding of.
You say far too late. You're still a child, actually. I mean, good food, it's still considered a sort of luxury item. In a strange way, although there's been a food revolution in this country, do you think there's been a food revolution? We certainly, you know, have many more restaurants cooking all kinds of different things. But do you think that actually, you know, fundamentally, the British attitude to food's changed?
I'm on slightly shaky ground because I'm only 33. And so a lot of what I understand about food before my time is received wisdom. And received wisdom can often either be coloured by nostalgia or its opposite.
No, I promise you, if you'd been around in the 1970s, so, you really would not have grown up interested in food.
I'm speaking carefully. I think what I can say is that when I was a kid, my mum wouldn't let me eat any meat because in the mid-80s, BSE started at home. And my mum, being a country girl, was like, well, it stands to reason. If you're going to feed animals, other animals, of course, everything must be completely screwed. And, you know, what happened as a result of BSE was we realised that certain kind of intensive approaches towards farming were not just incredibly bad for the animals, but also ultimately bad for us and totally unsustainable. And that started a kind of a re-understanding of thinking where now, and this seems crazy, but, you know, every shop has an organic section and organics is big business these days. Now, I would say also in the 90s, you had something similar that happened with regards to fishing, in that we suddenly started to get terribly worried that we were overfishing our stocks. And we're now in a period where people are having a similar understanding of the quality of vegetables. So over the last 30 years, we've now radically reappraised of how we produce foods, and also hand in hand with that, an idea that the more care and effort we put into its production, the better it tastes, and also the better it is for the world in which we live, which is a precious resource. That is, I would say, an enormously important revolution.
When you think about, you know, associating luxury with food, then is it for you very much about the freshness of ingredients, the seasonal nature of them and those things, rather than the kind of exotic, you know, would you sit and stick your face in a bowl of caviar?
I mean, I absolutely probably would. Caviar is pretty much the only expensive thing that gives me any pleasure whatsoever. I have a funny relationship with luxury, because a lot of objects to which the term luxury is ascribed to me don't seem luxurious at all. They seem mass-produced. They're made of expensive things, but essentially they're just rolling off a conveyor belt like anything else. And for me, true luxury relates to something which has been, it can be a very humble thing, but it's something that's had time and love invested in it, because those are actually very rare commodities. Time and skill, craftsmanship and love and care are increasingly rare commodities in contemporary society. And as a result, there's definitely truth in what you say. You know, a piece of meat, it can be a humble cut, it can be a flank steak, but if that comes from a cow which has been reared to 6 years old rather than being slaughtered at 18 months, and if it's been grown on beautiful pasture by someone who loves that cow and has really tended to it, and if it's then been slaughtered with great care and attention, and if it's then been dry-aged by a butcher who really knows their craft, that humble piece of steak, for me, is infinitely more luxurious than a piece of high-grade grain-fed feedlot beef that has been churned through a system of high production to make an incredibly well-marbled fillet steak. I would also say the same is true for vegetables. Do you know what I mean? It's a vegetable from a small, diverse, rich ecosystem with incredible soil, like a little radish from good soil, is infinitely more delicious than a piece of asparagus which has been flown halfway across the world and grown in a hydroponic polytunnel, which will have no flavor whatsoever. Now, our idea of luxury is skewed, basically. Food can be luxurious, but it's not the kind of rarity of it or the scarcity or the lengths that someone has gone to buy it that makes it luxurious. It's the care that's put into its production.
It seems also very much a kind of moment now, not just with food, but with almost everything, with people talking about, you know, renewing our connection with where the things that we consume come from, and that somehow if we can do that, that is a route to the future, or to a more sustainable future.
A lot of the condition of living in cities is an alienating one. It alienates us from the people around us, it alienates us from our environment, but it also alienates us from ourselves. One of the reasons I love cooking is if I'm ever feeling discombobulated or kind of, you know, ill at ease with myself, it's a very centering experience, and it kind of reestablishes that relationship with myself that some people get from exercise or whatnot. I feel like food also has an incredibly important and an almost ritualized role in establishing connection. You know, we think of sitting around a table and eating together as the kind of greatest expression of companionship. It's where the word companion comes from, of course. It also gives us a great sense of connection, not only to the people who produced it, but also to the ecosystem that supports us and sustains our life. I think that thinking about these things in a secular world, and I'm not a religious man, but in a secular world, is actually gives an important spiritual dimension to life, which I think when you lack it, you notice the absence of it.
I hate to bring it down from your elevated position thought process, but what's your favorite meal?
What is my favorite meal? That's an incredible. The worst question I ever get asked, and what's the last meal you want to eat before you die, or what's your death row meal?
Which That's is such depressing.
A miserable thought. I can never answer that because I don't know what I want to eat, but I always just think, God, if I get to the end of my life and I'm more worried about what I'm putting in my mouth than who I'm surrounded by, then I'll have done something very, very wrong. You know, the idea of eating caviar alone on my way out is
very scoffing
it. It's exactly, is pure Tony Montana. It's too depressing for words. No, I always just think, my favorite meal is always defined by the company I'm in. You know, ultimately, if I'm surrounded by my children and my wife and watching a sunset and drinking something delicious and or sipping hot chocolate and watching the sun go down, that'd be a lovely way to say goodbye.
But what might it be?
What might it be? God, I love fish and seafood. So anything that I've freshly caught and roasted over a fire in butter would be perfect.
Now, you've talked about what luxury isn't, but I think that you may have brought along something that you think is a luxury.
Yeah, I loved how hard I found this, because it shows...
This is live action, is by the way. He's just reaching into
my bag. So I bought a knife. Ooh. With me. I bought a knife. This was knife was made for me.
Is it a Japanese knife?
It's made in the style of Japanese steel knives.
Oh,
it's made
that by is a beauty.
It's made by a forge in Peckham.
It looks very well used.
I've had it for about 4 years and it's pretty battered.
Oh, it's all engraved though on the actual blade.
So yeah, it's multi-layered. So there's several hundred layers of two different
really
kinds of
sharp.
Steel.
I just nearly sliced my finger off with it.
For me, it's just a beautiful object. It was made for me. It's perfectly balanced to my grip. It's the handle was carved for me specifically to my specifications. It's not a fancy object. It's an object of utility. It's beautifully designed and it's perfect for what I need it to do. It's razor sharp and easy to maintain. It uses techniques that have been honed over thousands of years of kind of slow, incremental technological human advancement, but are still as pertinent now as they ever were. I mean, for me, it's beautiful. It connects me with the history of my craft. It's a Gyoto, which is the Japanese shape which most closely resembles a European chef's knife. So it has a longer blade, slightly angled, good for adept and delicate slicing towards the tip, but fairly speedy and heavy-duty knife work towards the heel. It's a perfect all-purpose knife in that you could chop a bag of onions in minutes, but also very, very delicately carve, you know, a sirloin from the bone and slice it.
And what about
dexterity.
The engraving? Why did you go for the blade being engraved?
So
that seems a very opulent detail.
This relates to the many layers of steel which are folded over to create the blade. So what you have is you have a very, very fine, hard core, which is the sharp element, and then it's protected by being wrapped in multi-layers of steel, which are then flattened onto it. And
stop
that's what
running
keeps
your
it
finger
solid.
On it, because it's making me so nervous.
But this is, I mean, this isn't ornamentation. This is actually the fabrication of the blade.
What about the handle? Because the handle actually seems far less ornate than the blade, which is quite unusual because often people go OTT on the handle, don't they?
The thing is that everything which is ornate and decorative about this knife is also serves a practical purpose or is part of its makeup. The handle is very simple. It's carved from a piece of old bog oak. It's probably about 5,000 years old or so. Bog oak, yeah. So woods which has been petrified and becomes incredibly hard and resistant to wear. And it's just carved simply to fit my grip in that it's rounded with my hand in mind. You know, it's not like getting a several row suit made. It's not like this wasn't a long or complicated process. It just involved me playing around with it for a bit, working with the forge who made it for me and making it kind of quite delicate specifications. So the handle carries enough weight to evenly balance the blade in my hand so I don't really notice it's there, which when you're holding and cutting all day long, it's surprising how exhausting it can be to use an unbalanced knife, even though it's not particularly heavy. You want something that feels like a natural extension of yourself.
I'm surprised you got into Harrods with it in your rucksack.
They're still chasing after me downstairs. I slipped through a back door.
But do you take it with you everywhere? I mean, is it the knife that you use to cook with or is it a knife that you treasure?
I both cook with it and treasure it. It's incredibly special to have this object that was made with so much care and attention, which I also get such incredibly good use out of. I have a heap of knives. I have far more knives than I can practically use. As a result, I've whittled this down now to kind of the four or five knives that I use every day. This is not only the most beautiful and the most carefully made, but it's also the most useful.
And just finally, we are in Harrods, and there are many departments for you to choose from. Which one would you find yourself wandering into if I gave you free rein, and what would you pick up if you could have anything in the building?
What a cliche, but the food hall. I mean, I was just down there. I have an amazing aunt, my Aunt Isabella, who's also my godmother. And as a treat, every year for my birthday, between the ages of about 5 and 11, she'd pick me up from school and take me in a black cab to Harrods and give me £50 to spend in the toy department. And it was just the biggest treat of my whole childhood. I looked forward to this every year with just, you know, the most overwhelming excitement. And I grew up in London, but for some reason, coming in a cab to Harrods, you know, we had a very frugal childhood. This was just the most treaty thing I could ever imagine. And coming back today, it was just like coming back and being that small child again. I was just kind of carried away by this sense of wonder. And of course, my first port of call was the food halls, which are just remarkably beautiful. I mean, I kind of wasn't expecting to be impressed by them. I really kind of was like, oh yeah, Harrods, right, I know what that's about. And I went in and I was like, this is outrageous. This is amazing. And I had a coffee and it cost £11 and it was the best coffee I've ever drunk.
The best.
I was like, it better be, but it was so delicious and everyone was so charming. If you were going to let me loose in Harrods, about the first place I would run and you would have to drag me out kicking and screaming would be the food halls.
And straight to that coffee bar.
Exactly.
I may head there myself now. Thank you very much, Jackson Boxer.
Thank you.
This has been True Tales of Luxury, recorded in Harrods in London with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Jackson Boxer. Goodbye.